supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Family is made possible in part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. Well, we've got a new term. It's called e-patient. Describes those of us who use the internet to decide on treatments, what we have, how we got it, what can be done about it. It's also used to connect with other patients and health professionals. As the e-patient movement continues to grow, a study by Pew and American Life Project shows that 61% of us go online to look for health information, and that number surely is climbing every year. So, although not every patient who does online research, though, has a positive experience, we don't know where to go, we don't know where valid information is, and many people wind up feeling more anxious or concerned. At the same time, physicians have not been used to working with patients with the internet. They have been trained to be the sole purveyors of medical information, and they have mixed feelings about it. Sometimes it's an asset, sometimes they feel it's a detriment. Well, on today's show, we're going to talk with two of my guests about how the internet is affecting patients, doctors, and healthcare in general in this country. Sharon Snitman is here in the studio with me. She's chronicled her own experience about the ups and downs of being an e-patient. Her bout with infertility prompted her to go online to learn more about her condition and treatment options. Sharon's an adolescent health researcher here at the University of Pennsylvania. Sharon, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
We are also joined by Paula Chen. She writes the weekly doctor-patient column in the New York Times. She's a liver transplant and cancer surgeon and works in the Boston VA healthcare system. She's also the author of Final Exam, A Surgeon's Reflections on Mortality. Pauline, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. I'm honored to be on your show.
And we want to hear from you, our listeners. Give us a call. Share your thoughts about using the internet to look up health information or ask our guest question. Our phone number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Sharon, let's start with you and your story. So it begins with 2 years ago. You started in vitro fertilization on the advice of your doctor after less invasive treatments didn't work. Like most patients, you had blind faith in your doctor and you didn't worry. You did whatever she said.
Yeah, that's right. I was very happy with just taking on this, I think, a traditional role of the patient as being very passive and meeting with my doctors. I had full trust, which I still do. I have full trust in my doctor. And I came in and she gave me advice of what the best treatment options for me were, and I didn't think more about it. I took those advice, and she said I just followed her opinion of what the best options were, and I was very happy with that kind of situation in the beginning.
Well, in the beginning,
right.
And then you went through your first round, and it didn't work, and you heard language like poor egg quality or poor embryo quality, and that began to change your comfort level. That's when you started to get anxious about
exactly those. And I think it was very much prompted by my expectations. So what happened was I was going through my first IVF cycle, and after 2 weeks of a lot of hormone shots and doctor visits, I was finally coming to this appointment where we were going to transfer the embryos to me, and then I was expecting my sense of what was going to happen was we were just going to do it. I wasn't prepared to hear any kind of information about my potential success rate of the treatment. I just thought we're going to go and do the embryo transfer, and then I was going to wait 2 weeks to see whether or not it worked. So I came in that day kind of relieved that the two first weeks of the very intensive treatment was over, and then we're going to do the transfer, and I was going to have this waiting period. That's what I was mentally prepared for that day. And when I came in, I was sitting there waiting for the doctor. She came in and she looked a bit serious. She sat down next to me and she explained to me that out of the five embryos that we had cultured, only two had survived until the day three, where the day of the transfer, and those were also not of the best quality. And I didn't even know about egg quality. I didn't even know there was an issue and whether or not the doctor could tell at this point whether or not they were good or not. So I was totally unprepared for this, and that's when I felt that it wasn't enough for me to take this passive role anymore. I felt that I had totally lost control over my meeting with the doctor because I wasn't prepared. I wasn't emotionally prepared to hear anything at that point that was supposed to be about the success rate of my treatment.
What happened to you in that meeting? You said you lost control of the meeting. What happened?
Well, my emotions changed so quickly that I couldn't articulate my feelings. I didn't know what questions to ask, and I didn't understand the situation. I just knew. My doctor told me that the embryos weren't as good as we were hoping for, and at that point when she said that, I couldn't take in any more information. That was my doctor went on telling me a lot of different things, but I didn't hear it. And
you were in a little bit of shock.
Yes.
Physiologically.
Exactly. I was in the shock. And I think that happens to a lot of us when our doctor tells us that some kind of treatment wasn't working as well as we had hoped for. It's hard to take in new information at that moment. So that's what happened.
You've written an extraordinary essay about this, and we've posted it on our website, or put a link on our website at whyy.org/voices. But in this essay, you wrote that the IVF process left you physically and mentally exhausted, more scared and anxious, and that you felt at that moment like a passive recipient.
Exactly. Because I didn't even know how to ask the right questions. Because in order to ask informative questions, there is a need for some kind of knowledge, even just to get to the questions. And I didn't have that even. And so I just felt that there wasn't, that I had lost control of the situation. And the other thing that I also felt was, which, you know, we know, is that medicine is not an exact science. And even my doctor was not fully in control. There's a lot of uncertainties, especially in IVF and infertility. There's a lot of things we do not know, and there's a wait and see and trial and error kind of process. And when I felt that my doctor also that the outcome wasn't as my doctor had expected, I even more felt that I needed to gain a little bit more control.
I'm surprised that it took you that long, given the fact that you're a researcher.
Yes, I'm surprised. Looking back at it, I'm very surprised myself. But I think a lot of us, that's the kind of patient-doctor relationship that I'm used to. That's the way I've seen that kind of relationship, that the doctor has the knowledge, the authority, the power in that relationship, and the patient takes on this very passive role. And I've grown up with that model, and that's always been the way that, you know, when as a kid, when we went to the doctors and my parents took me to the doctor, it was always that kind of process. Even my parents also didn't take an active role in those doctors' visits, so that's what I knew. That's just what I knew how to do these kind of things.
Yeah, I remember my parents didn't want me to ask the doctor too many questions. They didn't want me to bother them.
Right.
Pauline, is this still the case? I'd like you to weigh in on this issue, if you would. Do people tend to go to doctors in a passive position?
Well, I think it's very interesting what Jaron says and what you say about how you were traditionally raised to sort of view the patient-doctor relationship in a very traditional sort of hierarchical way. I think that's changing in the same way that people's use of the internet has been changing. There have been shifts toward more patient empowerment, and I think the internet has been an incredible tool, as Sharon's story shows, for patients to feel more empowered in that relationship. And as a result, you know, my thought is that the internet has also become an incredible tool to augment the relationship between patients and doctors.
I want to get to that, because it's also a potential source of conflict between patients and doctors, as you've written about a great deal. But I want to come back to you, Sharon, and when you began to use the internet and how. So at one point you decided you didn't want to be passive anymore. You know, you wanted to get control back of what you could get control. But you didn't know where to look or how, and you said in your essay you became obsessed.
Yeah, and I also don't think, on my part, it wasn't a conscious choice, I think, and a thought-through process that now I needed to gain control, I needed to go on the internet. It was more, I came home and was very sad and also confused, and the only thing I knew how to was to go online, Google any search word that I would find. And the problem, I think, with internet, and I definitely, and my story says that, is that I think that the internet has great power to empower patients and augment, as Dr. Chen just said, the augment the relationship with patients and doctors. But the internet is very confusing, and there's a lot of things out there that isn't high quality medical facts, and it's hard to know where to go. So I just started my online search, and Google would return hundreds of thousands of hits of on my keywords that I was searching, and I would start obviously at the top and wouldn't get that far because there were just too many pages to look through. And the first hits that Google would provide me would normally be online communities. That would be other IVF patients that were discussing their issues online.
You got involved. You got involved in online communities, yes?
No, I never ever. So I would be one of those people that would read their comments and a passive. I would be a passive participant because I would read the comments, but I've never posted anything. And the reason being is because I did not find comfort or in reading those.
What did you find?
I found a community of a lot of women that has gone through much more intensive treatments than I have without success. Some of them have been successful, but I was also introduced with all these women that were anxious and sad, and so I was introduced to all these risks. And in addition to that, they were giving each other medical advice that I did not trust because they're not medical doctors, and I felt that, you know, just on behalf of some kind of story, that you couldn't take anything from them.
Pauline, I'd like you to weigh on this also, because I would imagine these online communities, people can also find kindred spirits.
Yes, I think it's an incredibly powerful tool for patients who have chronic diseases. There was a recent report by the Pew Internet Group, the same group that you quoted early on in the show, that looked at patients who have chronic diseases, and while many of them have less access to the internet, they also tend to participate more in online communities and in social groups, groups like patient groups, which I think is very, very powerful, particularly for people with rare diseases, but all of us. I think, though, that Sharon points to a phenomenon that experts are sort of cautious about with internet groups, which is that emotions can sometimes be contagious, that if a certain group tends to be more negative, that it's very easy for someone who participates to sort of take on those emotions about the disease, about the therapy, about their condition. If the group's sort of emotions are more positive, it's easier to pick that sort of thing up.
Well, I also go on.
Oh, sorry, but the interesting thing to me has been in many of the studies that have looked at, you know, how much patients are hurt by information that is online, that Sharon refers to again, by sort of medical information given out, passed back and forth. You know, the data has been pretty consistent on that for the last 5 or so years, that only about 2 or 3% of adults, of patients who participate in e-patients feel that they or someone that they've known has been hurt by the medical advice that is passed on the in the internet. So I think a lot of people approach them, like Sharon has, with sort of, you know, interested in learning, but also some caution as well.
There was, you know, when Sharon was talking about this community that raised her anxiety, Pauline, I was thinking about the nature of that specific community. I mean, it's an IVF community, so these are, by definition, women who are frustrated and not finding success. And you know, by nature, this is going to be, you know, a source of anxiety. On the other hand, I blog weekly for the Christopher Reeve webpage, and you mm-hmm. talked about chronic conditions. I mean, that's a tremendous resource and you know, an avenue for all sorts of hope and information. So I would imagine it depends on the topic, too.
Yes, and I think it also points to an area that has been less explored in sort of the whole idea of using the internet for healthcare, for the patient-doctor relationship, and that is how can this information, how can these communities also help to inform doctors, to give doctors greater insight, for instance, into the patient experience. You know, there was a study done a while ago, and I can't reference the exact study, but it looked at patients with migraines. And, you know, what may be important for a doctor during the examination, the questions that are important, the answers that are important, may not be the same for patients. So the doctor may be interested in the timing of the episodes of pain and the duration and what triggers them, whereas for the patient, you know, who's coming in for the first time, the most important question may be, you know, am I going to die from this? And so I think that the internet as a tool for patients has just, you know, is the potential is just limitless. But I think its potential as sort of an information source for doctors to learn about the patient experience has only just begun to sort of be sort of looked into.
I want to touch on that relationship and come back to you, Sharon. Once you began researching and felt more in control and you were able to find the questions you wanted to ask, there was a point at which you found information about alternative treatments for IVF that were less expensive and less invasive and treatments your doctor never discussed with you. And you brought this information to your doctor, but I'm wondering, did that have an impact on your feelings about your doctor, your trust?
No, and I want to emphasize that the doctors and the nurses that have been treating me, even through my process, I mean, I'm very pleased, and we have a very good relationship. And my doctor had, before we started IVF, we had done less invasive treatments. And when they didn't work, me and my doctor had decided, I had decided, I guess, that we were going to do an IVF. After an IVF, my doctor was probably thinking in the same line, continuing IVF. But at that point, I was emotionally and physically exhausted, and I couldn't even bear thinking of just going through another IVF at that point. So I had changed my mind and remembered and online looked and to find these alternative treatments. So it was that my doctor probably had gone on this sort of way of thinking that we were going to do IVF, but the internet had helped me realize again that there are other alternatives, and I could take into account how I was feeling emotionally at that time and said, this is not the best way for me, and I could tell my doctor that.
How? I mean, the internet is fraught with all sorts of different treatment interventions that, you know, are snake oil. So how did you sort out, and Pauline, I want to hear your thoughts about this too, how did you sort out what is viable, what's got some validity to it?
Yeah, that's the great question. I think that is the most difficult thing for patients who go online, is to find out exactly that. And as I said, the communities of other IVF patients, personally, that did not help me very much. But there are other websites out there that are written by fertility specialists, and they would just, and I just found them by chance by looking online, searching the web, and they would just come up. And it was by chance in a way that they come up on the first three couple of pages, because I would never really go beyond that.
It's sad that it's done by chance. So, Pauline?
Yes.
So how would what we're calling e-patients, you know, they're going to find magic cures for everything imaginable. How do we sort out what's viable and what's not?
Well, I think if you look at the, you know, both Sharon's experience, which she really beautifully documents in her essay, but also the data on how patients search for information on the internet or search for medical information in general, most patients, the overwhelming majority of patients, actually also consult their physician or a healthcare professional or healthcare provider to ask, you know, what should I do? How should I approach this? They will also, a large number of people will also consult friends and family. And so it's a multi-step process. I think people rarely will make the decision based on a single isolated finding, but we'll take that and we'll sift through it and consider it and work through it with several of the people in their life that deal with healthcare. And so I think that sort of feeds into what's so powerful about the internet, and which I think ultimately is a positive thing, because it is a source for more discussion, for more debate, for talking about, you know, what is the best thing for me. There's this information out there, but for me, for my particular constellation of symptoms, of signs, of, you know, my body, how I've reacted to things, how does this fit for me?
We've got to take a short break, and when we come back, I want to talk about the doctor-patient relationships that, you know, patients are more ahead of the curve here with the internet than doctors are. So I want to hear about how we can bring doctors up to speed on this whole issue. I was just talking with Pauline Chen, who joins us by phone. She writes a weekly doctor and patient column for the New York Times. We heard from Sharon Snitman. She wrote about her own experience about being an e-patient, and we have her essay on our webpage at whyy.org/voices. She's an adolescent health researcher at the University of Pennsylvania. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. That's right here on WHYY FM.
WHYY gives you a chance to listen to and even talk to some of the most important newsmakers, authors, and creative people. Because you're listening right now, we know that WHYY is valuable to you. Did you know that your financial support helps WHYY air this program and all of the other programs that you listen to? As we close out our fiscal year, you can help support WHYY by becoming a member at 1-888-345-9499 or online at whyy.org. For a pledge of $60, ask for the I Heard It on NPR, I Heard It on WHYY mug. And if you put it on a credit card, you can get a full year's subscription to Newsweek magazine. Any level you pledge, we appreciate it. 1-888-345-9499 or online whyy.org. Thanks so much for listening, and thanks for your support.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about the internet today and its impact on healthcare, our relationship with our doctors, and frankly, our relationship with our bodies. My guests are Sharon Snitman. She wrote about her own experience, about the ups and downs of being an e-patient, and she wrote that on a beautiful essay that's on our web page. She's an adolescent health researcher at the University of Pennsylvania. Pauline Chen joins us by telephone. She writes the weekly Doctor and Patient column, and her most recent book's called Final Exam, A Surgeon's Reflections on Mortality. Our phone number is 888-477-9499. Do you use the internet to research health for yourself, your children, your parents? Does it help you, or does it raise your anxiety? And do you bring your information to your doctor? What does your doctor have to say about that? 888-477-9499. So, Pauline, where we last left off was Sharon brings alternative treatments up to her doctor and says, this is what I found online. What do you think of this? I would imagine many doctors would be offended hearing that.
I think it really depends on the physician and how comfortable the physician is with the internet and social media and online resources. I think more and more doctors, more and more healthcare systems, more and more hospitals are understanding, are sort of embracing the power of the internet, of e-patients and of social media, and using online sources, websites, giving patients websites for further information. I think this is one area of the patient-doctor relationship where it, you know, also can add to the relationship in that it can help physicians and patients be more quote-unquote time efficient. When a physician has 15 minutes to see somebody, because of the way healthcare is now structured, there's not much time that a doctor can spend with each patient. That time can actually be expanded in many ways by harnessing the internet, by harnessing those websites, those informative websites, and having patients look at them and reflect on things. Sharon mentioned earlier in the show about being told that her embryos were not of a certain quality, and of being stunned by that information. I think that happens so much along the way in healthcare, in the patient-doctor relationship, that the doctor will deliver a piece of information, and it comes so suddenly, and it's the first time and the only time for that patient to receive that kind of information, whereas the doctor has been doing it sort of, depending on the specialty, of course, day in and day out. What the internet can do and what informative websites can do is allow patients to explore that, to let it sink in, to think about that, to research that, and then to come back, which I believe is what Sharon also did. She documents in her essay, go back to the doctor and say, listen, you know, I've had time to think about it. I've researched it. I've looked at the sites, and let's talk about another way of approaching this, or maybe isn't there another way, or I've heard about another way of approaching this problem. And that can be very helpful for the physicians as well. I think that, you know, nobody knows what they're going through like the patient does. And for a patient to be informed in that way and to bring to the table this information and these ideas, I think can actually be very, very helpful for doctors and patients. I think, though, that as you mentioned earlier, it's been a cultural transition. It's been a slow transition, a slow change. And many physicians, you know, when I went to medical school, we weren't trained in this. This was so far in the future that we didn't understand.
Well, are they trained today? Do you know?
You know, more and more. It's absolutely fascinating to me. More and more in many different things. I think some of the young doctors now, some of the medical students now, they are so savvy about the internet and about websites and about social media, they are in many ways teaching their teachers and helping their patients through. And so sometimes what's interesting to me, sometimes with some of the younger physicians and the older patients, you again get a kind of cultural gap where the younger physicians are more like, well, why don't you, you know, should I email you the results? And the patients may not be that comfortable with email or that comfortable with accessing a website to interact with their physician practices. There are many physician practices now that have websites for patients to sort of check in with the practice regarding some of their chronic diseases.
And I would also imagine the cultural differences also goes the other way with younger patients and older doctors. Sharon, you wanted to...
I just wanted to add to exactly what Dr. Shen is mentioning here, is that when I came back to my doctor with my research that I'd found, my doctor embraced that and talked to me about what I'd found and helped me, frankly, make sense of it, because a lot of it just confused me and I didn't understand whether or not it applied to my situation, because it's hard to put it into context, really, a lot of this information, whether or not it applies. So once I took it to my doctor, she helped me become empowered by the internet. And without my doctor's help, I wouldn't have been able to really benefit, I think, from the internet. What I think also Dr. Chen is getting at, and what I experience, is that the clinic that I've been treated at hasn't been very proactive in this situation. So it took my cue to include the internet in my treatment, and it didn't come from my doctors. And I wish that when I entered, my doctor would have actively asked me in the beginning, have you looked online? Is there anything you wonder? And do you have any questions about it or something like this, so that it would open up for this discussion? That would have helped me a lot.
And in the ideal scheme of things, your doctor would have suggested various internet sites.
Exactly, and pointed out to make sure that if I find something else online, that I check that it's quality information and the date, because a lot of the stuff online is also outdated.
See, Pauline...
Yeah.
You know, I'm thinking about doctors recommending various sites to their patients, but in order to be able to do that, that's labor intensive. To find which sites, to know which is valid and which works, is that asking too much of them to do this research?
That's a great question, but I think that ultimately that it ends up being a time-saving and positive thing to do. If you can, find sites for your patients on hypertension or diabetes that are very helpful, and you can give them to several patients, I think it's a win-win situation.
Yeah, I went to the doctor few years ago for a consultation down in Baltimore for symptoms that nobody could really understand. And he said to me that my symptoms were consistent with myasthenia gravis. And that was it. And I left. And I, same thing, a little shocky. I know it was an autoimmune disease. And I didn't know what to ask. And I left and I looked it up online. And an hour later, I was picking out which music I wanted for my funeral. It's like I didn't have a context here. So the internet can certainly be good news and bad news. Listen, ladies, we've got a lot of callers who want to join the conversation, and they've been patiently waiting.
Sorry about that experience. That sounds terrible.
Yeah, no, I didn't enjoy it much. No. We've got Catherine on the line. Catherine, hi. You're on Voices.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call. My daughter has had Lyme's disease and trigeminal neuralgia at 28 years old, both very severe. And I think looking up things on the internet have been invaluable although you don't trust everything you see. But from my experience of a hospital stay where she was had this severe pain with the trigeminal neuralgia, the doctor came in at one point and said, I don't think your pain is related to this because I looked up trigeminal neuralgia on the web. I think that's something you don't want to hear your doctor to say. But and his information was wrong, but sometimes the doctor should go on. I just thought I'd make that comment.
Yeah, and any reaction to that from Pauline?
Yes, I think that's a very good point, Catherine. That's an excellent point. There are sites online for physicians that patients can access as well, but that are, for instance, I can think of offhand one called UpToDate. And they're compiled by experts in the field and are kept relatively up to date with the newest research. And so as a physician, you can access that and look at sort of the newest data that has been ongoing or that has been coming out, newest therapies, some of the pros and cons. So that can be very helpful. I think it would also, it's also been helpful in my own experience to read about patients' experiences. So looking at the other side of what Catherine's daughter went through, the pain of the trigeminal neuralgia, I mean, I have not had that condition myself, but to read about it or to learn about it is quite eye-opening, and I think it can only help with empathizing with your patient as much as you can.
Let's thanks for your call, Catherine. Let's take another call before we go to our break. We've got Yale on the line.
Hi.
Hi, Yale.
I use internet extensively, but I use it with a lot of due diligence. If I'm dealing with something, a new topic, the valuable thing I get out of it is that I learn a lot of vocabulary that helps me do further research and helps me know what kind of questions to ask. Another point that I'd need to share with you is when I visit a doctor, I bring two things, another person as an advocate and a voice recorder, so I can replay it afterwards and make sure I understood what I thought I heard.
That is good advice universally. I think both points are excellent, and I see Sharon nodding her head. What's your reaction?
No, I think that's... I wish I would have had that recorder when my doctor told me about the embryos, because I just couldn't take in any of that information. And doctors are busy people. I couldn't call up the day after and just ask, could you please repeat everything you just said? Because it's hard to get the doctor on the line there. So if I had had that, that would have been very helpful for me. So I think that's great advice.
Well, I'm going to take what you said, and we're going to take a break, but I want to cue the next session because you couldn't call the doctor and repeat what you just said, but I happen to know about Pauline that she tweets, and I hope I didn't just out you here.
No.
I said, oh, okay. So we'll talk about that more later after the break. So we're talking about, I was trying to think of a cute follow-up, but I couldn't. We're talking about e-patients using the internet to find out about our bodies and what impact that has on how we feel about our bodies, how we feel about our doctor-patient relationships, and what impact it has on our doctors. My guests are Pauline Chen. She joins us by phone. She writes the Doctor and Patient column for The Times, and she's written Final Exam, A Surgeon's Reflections on Mortality. I'm also joined here in the studio by Sharon Snitman. She wrote about her own experience as an e-patient. We've got that eloquent essay on our webpage, whyy.org/voices, and she's an adolescent health researcher at the University of Pennsylvania. Our phone number is 888-477-9499. We'd love to hear from you if you're a doctor, your feelings about the internet and how that's affected your work. Again, that's 888-477-9499. 9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY FM.
Hello, Ed Cunningham here at WHYY to tell you about a challenge we're facing here at Public Media. Our membership roles are larger than ever, and we're delighted. The problem, though, is that because of the weak economy, the amount of the pledges we've been receiving in each case has been smaller, and that's where you come in. Our challenge is to find more folks like you who may not already be members to join our ranks. Why not call right now at 1-888-345-9499 with your membership pledge of $50 or more. You can also pledge online at whyy.org. Choose one of our gift ideas and make sure you tell the operator that if you make a membership pledge on a credit card, they'll sign you up for Newsweek magazine for a full year. It's our way of saying thanks for helping us to meet the challenge of keeping WHYY strong for another fiscal year.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We are talking about the internet and how that's affected how medicine works, how the whole, it's what impact it's had on the whole healthcare system. My guests are Pauline Chen, who joins us by phone. She writes the weekly doctor and patient column for The Time. Sharon Snitman is an adolescent researcher at University of Pennsylvania. She chronicled her own experience about the ups and downs of being an e-patient. Pauline, as I said before the break, you've written in your columns about social networking between doctors and patients, and you've explored medicine in the age of Twitter and how texting by medical professionals can help patients actually maintain their health. So say more about that, because that's just, maybe I'm being overprotective of doctors, but that's another thing that seems labor-intensive.
It is, but I think one thing that has occurred in as we've started to open up sort of new horizons of the internet into the patient-doctor relationship is that we've started to ask, what are the limits and are there any limits, which is what I think you're driving at. So, for instance, when email first started coming into the picture with patients and doctors, we weren't really sure how much you could email and, you know, could you email diagnostic tests to a patient? How extensively could you email about a topic with patients? This is from the doctor's perspective. And how much time should email be in one's practice, or should you focus more on actually sitting in the exam room and sort of seeing the patient? And I think it was much like when the phone sort of came into use. How much can you use the phone? There have been guidelines written now about email as to how much patients and doctors, you know, what are sort of the professional ethics, the professional guidelines. But the same things have not been done with other aspects of social media like Twitter and texting. Like, how much can you text? Can you text a diagnosis? Can you Twitter recommendations to a patient? Can you tweet recommendations? Those things are still unexplored and not really delineated, so it's still very, very new. But that being said, there are definitely physicians out there and physician groups, journals, patient groups, e-patients that are very actively exploring all of those ways of connecting with one another and of communicating with one another.
It's a fascinating direction here, and
absolutely,
you know, as a psychologist, I think in terms of what it does to the relationship. Sharon, did you email with your doctor?
No, it did, and it never came up. I don't even think they actually do that as a part of their practice. They would call me with all the results, and I actually, if I had the option, I would much rather have had it by email, because then I would myself have a record over it, and I could go back and see, you know, Google it and check if my levels is a symptom of something that I should be looking at.
I want to tell you both. I've got email access to two of my doctors, and it really has changed my relationship with them. It feels more personal, and it feels almost like the old-fashioned home visits, mm-hmm. Because I don't need much more. If I've got a question, I don't need much more than a couple of sentences, and there's a quality of caring that comes across in just a couple sentence email. Sure.
And in addition to that, like your last caller said with the recorder, that we forget what our doctor tells us. And if you have it on email, you can just go back and look at it.
We've got a caller on the line, a physician. Madeline? Madeline?
Yes, this is Madeline.
Hi.
Hi.
You're on the air.
Oh, great. Well, I am actually a primary care physician. I'm an internist in the community. And I was calling actually with a couple of points that I wanted to make listening to this fascinating discussion. I think one point is that being a primary care doctor, and in this day and age with all of the technology that we do have at our fingertips, I think patients are going to go to the internet. And I think as physicians, we need to realize that and understand that. And I think, as you have already pointed out nicely, I think it's really important for us to direct patients to websites that we do feel are valid, well-researched, well-reviewed websites, such as the UpToDate for both physicians and patients. I also think it's really, really important for physicians to be able to say, I don't know, when they don't know the answer. I think we all have a tendency to feel like, we should know the answers to things. And instead of pretending that we don't, I think physicians need to be comfortable to say, I don't know, but I'm willing to look into that with you.
What do you recommend patients? Where do you recommend they go, and how have you found these sites?
Yeah, I mean, I think the site that you had brought up, the UpToDate, is a website that has both a physician section and a patient section, and it's a well-researched and periodically updated site, so I think that's actually a good site to start with.
Let me stop you there. What is it again?
It's called UpToDate.
One word?
It's three words, up to date.
Okay.
So in other words, they keep their information up to date. And the other, their website is actually good at directing you also to other websites that are clinically reviewed, well-researched sites.
Okay. All right. So do you do much research on this to pass on to patients?
When patients come in to me with information that they may have found on the internet that I don't know about, often what I will do is then tell the patient that I would love to look into that with them. Because I think patients, we're a team, working as a team to try and provide care, and the patients and the physicians need to be making decisions together. So when they come in with information that they've gotten off the internet that I haven't seen before, I think it's important for me then to look into it and research it and then to be able to help them decide, was this valid or was this not valid?
You've been kind enough to call, listen to the show, call in the show and say something nice about it. Now I have to ask you a personal question.
Mm-hmm.
How long have you been practicing?
I've been in practice, since I started practicing in 1997. So what would that be?
You're a relative, it's 13 years.
Mm-hmm.
You're a relatively younger generation. I wonder if doctors, and I'd like to hear your thoughts on yours, Pauline, if doctors 10, 15 years your senior would have the same attitude about partnering with the patient.
Right. I think, I think being in the younger generation and being trained in the, patient care model where we really are trying to look at all aspects of things certainly has helped. And I think you're right, the older generation, it may be more difficult. But I think in this day and age, with the internet, with the information that patients have access to, I think it's just crucially important in terms of establishing a good patient-doctor relationship.
Mm.
Because if you're not going to be on their team to help research something, then they're going to go elsewhere because they want somebody who's going to be able to work with them and be able to help guide them through so much of the information that's out there.
Well, I want to thank you so much for your call. Sounds like your patients are fortunate to have you for a doctor.
Oh, my pleasure. My pleasure. And thanks for the interesting discussion.
Thanks, Madeline. Sharon, are you still pursuing treatment for your infertility?
Yes. Yes, I am.
Same doctor?
Well, until now, the only reason why it wouldn't be that in the future is because I'm moving. So yeah. Otherwise, I would continue with the same doctor.
Still in vitro?
Yeah. Well, I guess that's open to discussion when I meet my new doctor, but I guess so.
Hmm. Yeah. So what advice would you give doctors about using the internet?
To be more proactive, because I think what research is telling us is that there is the majority of their patients will go online, and for the doctors to be proactive about that situation and then just open up for the discussion when they meet with their patients. Where do they go online? Do they have any questions regarding what they have found online? Suggest websites that they might use that are reliable, that have up-to-date information. And if I may just say from something, if I may not speak only as a patient but also as a researcher, I think that the research community also needs to come up to date, and we don't really have a lot of research that focuses on the effect of the internet on patients' experiences of their illness and their treatments, on the effect on the patient-physician relationships and that kind. So I think once we also have a lot more research on it, that could hopefully move on the discussion between doctors.
Once that happens, you will call me and we will get Pauline back and have another show on that topic. Unfortunately, we're out of time. I want to thank both of you so much for this interesting and important topic.
Thank you.
My guests have been Pauline Chen and Sharon Snitman. Chen's a liver transplant and cancer surgeon. She writes a weekly New York Times column, Doctor and Patient. Sharon's an adolescent health researcher at the University of Pennsylvania, and she chronicled her experience with the internet, and it's posted on our website, whyy.org/voices, and that's where you can reach us directly also. Next week, we're going to be talking about the mature marriage. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez-Loon is our executive producer. Mike and Scott's our executive producer. Stephanie Marudis is our producer. Evan Pliss is our intern. I'm Dan Gottlieb.